Welcome to a recording from a La Trobe Asia public event. Asia is at a dangerous moment. China is rising fast and its regional ambitions are growing. Reckless North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un may be assembling more nuclear weapons, despite diplomatic efforts to eradicate his arsenal. Japan is building up its military, throwing off constitutional constraints imposed after World War II. The United States, for so long a stabilizing presence in Asia, is behaving erratically. The possibility of global catastrophe looms ever closer. This event launches a new book from Brendan Taylor, titled The Four Flashpoints: How Asia Goes to War, from La Trobe University Press. Brendan is an associate professor at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University. He is in conversation with Professor Nick Bisley, head of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at La Trobe University. The event was introduced by La Trobe University Pro Vice Chancellor International, Kelly Smith. It was recorded at the State Library of Victoria on the 22nd of August 2018.
Good evening, everyone. Wonderful to see you all here. Welcome to How Asia Goes to War, a La Trobe Asia event in conjunction with La Trobe University Press. My name is Kelly Smith and I am Pro Vice Chancellor International at La Trobe University, and I'm also a member of the La Trobe Asia Steering Committee. And on behalf of the Chair of the Steering Committee, Professor Keith Nugent, I'd like to welcome you to the event this evening. I'd like to start by acknowledging the Wurundjeri Boonwurrung people, custodians of the land that we're gathered on this evening, pay my respects to their people and elders, past, present, and emerging. Pay my respects to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people who are here this evening, and to any elders who are with us this evening. La Trobe University is very proud of our efforts to engage the public in thoughtful debate and to deepen our understanding and knowledge of the region in which we live. The work of La Trobe Asia is an example of such efforts, as is our collaboration with Black Ink Books on La Trobe University in the book that we are very proud to be launching this evening, The Four Flashpoints, How Asia Goes to War by Brendan Taylor, Associate Professor of Strategic Studies at the Australian National University. In this book, Brendan examines the four Asian flashpoints that are most likely to erupt in sudden and violent conflict: the Korean Peninsula, Taiwan, the South China Sea, and the East China Sea. Brendan will be in conversation this evening with Professor Nick Bisley, who is head of the School of Humanities and Social Sciences at La Trobe University, and until very recently, the director of La Trobe Asia. Following the conversation, there will be an opportunity for a Q&A session. So I hope that you all came prepared with questions for the panel this evening. It's a fascinating topic, and these sessions usually generate a great deal of conversation and interest. So please join me in welcoming Brendan and Nick tonight. Nick, over to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Kelly. And I should say from the start, thank you all for coming, and it's a real pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure simply to be part of these things and not have to organise them. And the bits and pieces around it now, I'm just a talking head at La Trobe Asia, not part of the nervous system, so it's a real pleasure to be back. And Kelly probably should have mentioned, and probably will mention again, that you can buy copies of this book in the foyer afterwards, so I hope you came with your credit card or piles of cash. So I wanted to start, Brendan, with sort of the big picture around the book. And we've got the four flashpoints, as Kelly said, the Korean Peninsula, the Taiwan Straits or Taiwan status, the territorial disputes in the South and East China Seas. These are all old. These date from the immediate post-Second World War period. They are always a consequence of the way the war ended, particularly the way in which Europe, where the Axis forces were forced out of everywhere they had seized in East Asia. Essentially, the bombs in Nagasaki and Hiroshima meant that the war ended and Imperial Japan was still kind of out in the field, so to speak. So these things are seven decades old in many respects. Why have they become heated now? So why write a book about how Asia goes to war over four flashpoints that are quite old?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, Nick, and thanks to you and thanks to La Trobe Asia for having me here tonight, and thanks to everyone for coming along. But when I was thinking about, I looked around the region and was looking for a really big question to tackle, it struck me that that Asia is at quite a dangerous moment at present. We've got a China that's becoming much more assertive and confident, more strident, a China that's whose regional ambitions are becoming more apparent after several decades of adhering to a so-called biting and hiding policy. We've got in the United States in the form of Donald Trump, a president who's behaving a lot less predictably than past administrations. On the Korean Peninsula, we've got a North Korea that's nuclearizing at quite an alarming rate. And this is something all of the countries in the region quite nervous, including Australia. And it's certainly, there's a number of authors, you know, people like Graham Allison from Harvard University. There's been a whole slew of books coming out saying that, you know, the chances of war are increasing in Asia at the moment. There's a chance of a big clash, for instance, between the US and China. But what I didn't see as I surveyed the landscape of these, you know, this cottage industry of books that are coming out is exactly how Asia would go to war or where it might go to war. And there's lots of analysis about why it might go to war. And I work in a field called strategic studies, and one of the jobs of a strategic studies scholar is to try and, despite the fact that we often get given bad press for kind of being war fondlers, is to actually to try and avoid major power conflict. That's why this field of study was set up in the late 1940s at the ending of the Cold War. And so what I did is really use the... I mean, war could break out anywhere, but logic suggests that, and if you want to try and anticipate, it's a very difficult thing to do, but you want to try and anticipate where a conflict is going to break out. You kind of look at the kind of the geographic areas where it's most likely to break out or where it's been thought to have been most likely to break out. So that was one of the reasons why I looked at these four flashpoints. They're really a device for getting at that kind of bigger question about, you know, how likely is war in Asia if it does break out? Where is it likely to break out and what can we do to prevent it?
You include India because, you know, when I teach this stuff, when you run your thumb down the hotspots, the subcontinent's a big part of this story, and whether that's the small matter of 3,000 kilometres of unresolved border disputes between India and China or the not inconsiderable dispute between India and Pakistan where two nuclear armed states are at serious loggerheads, why not include them?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, and I'm very, very lucky that my editor for this book, Chris Figg, is here this evening, so maybe I can have a chat to him about a sequel called The Five Flashpoints.
The Fifth Flashpoint.
But it was, in all honesty, it's something that I did think very, very seriously about. I mean, I think the flashpoints, both the tensions between China and India, and I know, Nick, that you've written about this last year, when tensions flared up over the Doklam Plateau in the Himalayas. We've also had India and Pakistan go close to nuclear war on occasions. But I suppose what led me to stick with the four flashpoints in East Asia was I was reading a book that was written back in the 1970s by a very famous Australian historian called Geoffrey Blainey. And this book is a very famous book called The Causes of War. And one of the things that Blainey talks about in this book is a phenomenon that he describes as wide war. It's different than a localized conflict. It's a conflict, a type of conflict that doesn't come along all that often, but it's a type of conflict that brings in all of the major powers or a number of the major powers into conflict. And when I look at those tensions, say, across the Doklam Plateau, I can't envisage a situation where the US could get drawn into that or Japan could get drawn into that. Similarly with a conflict involving India and Pakistan. They would certainly be serious conflicts, but I think they would remain contained to a great extent. We wouldn't see them kind of escalate into a conflict that kind of was on the scale of the type of conflict we saw in the First and Second World War. So it was really, though, the prospect for wide war that I was really interested in, and I saw in potentially in these four flashpoints, although as we'll go on to discuss, some of them I think have greater potential than others, but it was really that potential for wide war that I was looking at.
Yeah, the idea of an India-China conflict being contained is a difficult thing to get your head around when you're talking about the scale of those two countries. But I get what you're saying, that the prospect of this thing spiraling into systemic conflict that brings particularly the US into the equation.
And that might change in the future as well. Like, PricewaterhouseCoopers, I don't know if they're one of your sponsors or not, so I hope I'm not giving...
There's a partner in the room. Yes. They're very welcome to if they wish.
Well, he'll be... Mark, good to see you. I think they've done some really interesting work looking at projections for where the world's economies are likely to go out to the year 2050. And, I mean, one's always got to be a bit careful about these long-term extrapolations. But I think if those projections are right and we see China and India becoming the world's two leading economies by the year 2050, then there may be potential for a wide war to be sparked if those economic changes also translate into strategic changes. But I think for the time being, that's still some way off. I think for over the next couple of decades at least, I think that the prospect for wide war emanating out of South Asia are more remote in my view.
Yeah. Well, we might hold that thought on, but as a strategic studies bomb fondler, which is a concept, a term I hadn't heard before, but I kind of like it, you're used to the famous American acronym of BLUT. What's your sense on this? If we start now, and we'll unpack it as we go through our conversation in the Q&A. What do you reckon the percentages of a wide war teeing off by one of these four flashpoints?
Well, it sounds like a simple question, but actually the answer is a little bit more complicated, because one of the things that I try and do in the book is not only look at the flashpoints in isolation. I mean, one of the things I try to point out is that they're subtly different, and that the mechanisms for control for managing these flashpoints are different in each case. They don't lend themselves to a one-size-fits-all approach. But one of the things that I try to do in the book is also look at the interrelationships between the four flashpoints. And I borrowed an idea from a very famous strategic intellectual, the late Coral Bell. Back in the 1970s, Coral was writing about an idea called a crisis slide, where she suggested that in the periods before the First World War and the Second World War, what we saw was a succession of international crises, and the momentum from each of those started to build, and the pressure started to build, and eventually the cumulative pressure of those international and built up and pushed Europe towards war. And I think if we look at Asia at the moment, I think there's something similar going on at the moment, that we're in the midst of a crisis slide that started back around about 2010, when we saw a couple of fairly serious crises on the Korean Peninsula, and subsequently we've seen international crises in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, back again on the Korean Peninsula. And I argue that there's an even bigger crisis brewing in Taiwan at the moment. So I'm certainly interested in the relationships between the four flashpoints. But at the same time, I think one of the keys to arresting a crisis slide is to try and look at the most dangerous or at any given time. And these odds can shift over time. For instance, if we were having this conversation back in 12 to 2014, around that period, we'd probably say that the odds of China and Japan going to war were higher then than they are now. So certainly now I would say that the odds of that are lower. I rate the East China Sea flashpoint as number three on my list of the four. It might be surprising to many in the audience that I actually rank the South China Sea, the one that we here in Australia hear the most about. I rank that as the flashpoint that's least likely to combust. I would say the odds of that combusting into major power conflict are somewhere in the order of about 0 to 5%. The two most dangerous are the Korean Peninsula. I think that certainly a lot of the heat has gone out of the Korean Peninsula. The Trump-Kim summit back in June, and the earlier inter-Korean summit, I think those were good developments, but I don't think we're out of the woods on that particular flashpoint yet. I think if the diplomacy goes off the rails, as it has done in the past on this very difficult and protracted flashpoint, we could find ourselves back in a situation where Donald Trump begins to look again at military options. I think it's unlikely, but not inconceivable. The flashpoint that I worry most about, and where I think the odds of conflict, I place them up in the mid-20s to 30% range, are actually in Taiwan, or over Taiwan, the flashpoint that we hear least about. And we can perhaps go on to talk a little bit more about why I think that's the most dangerous points at present.
Okay, well, I might... why don't we start with Taiwan? Because I had had a little order in mind, but we can start with Taiwan and then skirt our way back to the Korean Peninsula. So why? Okay, if we say Taiwan is the one that's most explosive, that sort of flies in the face, I think, of a lot of conventional wisdom of the past few years, which is Taiwan's kind of, we've sorted that one out for the moment. It's cross-strait relations are okay. The flights are back up and going. Yes, we've got Tsai Ing-wen, but she's nothing like the more independence-minded leaders of previous years, and that, you know, we think we, from a big picture point of view, the Met got this one managed. So why do you think it's so potentially explosive?
Yes, well, you're right, Nick, that it's a flashpoint that's had a couple of decades of dormancy, and we've seen this pattern before. As far as the Taiwan flashpoint is concerned, we saw back in the 1950s during the Cold War a couple of fairly serious crises across the Taiwan Strait, one in which the United States threatened to use nuclear weapons against Taiwan, in defence of Taiwan. We saw another crisis in the mid-1990s in the lead-up to Taiwan's first democratic presidential election. But certainly the last couple of decades have been fairly stable on the Taiwan Strait. But these periods of dormancy have a habit of coming to crisis situations rather quickly. And I think that if we look at some of the deeper trends that are happening in the triangular relationship between China, Taiwan, and the United States at present, I see that there's a dangerous cocktail emerging there or being mixed there at the moment. I think we see in Taiwan itself, if you look back to the early 1990s when polling on these issues first began, many Taiwanese, in fact, a majority of Taiwanese saw themselves as both Chinese and Taiwanese. If you look at the polls today, a growing percentage, it's up around the 60% mark of the 23 million inhabitants of the island, see themselves as being exclusively Taiwanese. And that trend becomes more pronounced. 100% of those see themselves as being exclusively Taiwanese, which is pretty understandable. They weren't born on the mainland, they were born on Taiwan. So I think certainly, I think Tsai Ing-wen's election is probably a symptom of something much deeper that's going on in Taiwan. There's a less and less of sense of affinity with the mainland. And I think that certainly that's one of the dangerous parts of this equation. I think on the other hand, we see in China a leader who's becoming much more assertive in relation to this issue. Xi Jinping has been much more strident than his predecessors have been over the issue of Taiwan. Some of his predecessors like Mao Zedong or Deng Xiaoping suggested that this issue could be deferred for 100 or even 1,000 years. Xi Jinping, in a number of big speeches, one delivered at the end of last year and one earlier this year, has said that this flashpoint can no longer be passed. This dispute can no longer be passed from generation to generation. So I think his credibility is on the line. And also China's ability to affect change through coercion is increasing. Then in the United States, you also have an administration whose approach to the Taiwan issue is very different to previous administrations. The Trump administration, and admittedly it's not just a feature of Trump, it's also due to congressional pressure, has really begun to start leaning in on this issue. And my is that one of the reasons why Trump and the US are leaning in on Taiwan on this issue at the moment is actually not a sign of US strength, it's actually a sign of US weakness on this particular issue. I think if we look at the military balance of power between the United States as far as this particular flashpoint is concerned, the US still holds the upper hand in that balance, but that balance is gradually reaching an equilibrium point. And for reasons of strategic geography, I argue in the four flashpoints that the ability of the United States to come to the defence of Taiwan, as it's been able to in the past, will be gone in 7 to 8 years. It'll be gone within the decade. So that's one of the reasons why I think that next decade is going to be a particularly dangerous period as far as this flashpoint is concerned, and why I see it as being the most combustible of the four.
So as a result, and I think the the most controversial proposition in the book is essentially that the US should see the writing on the wall. 5 to 10 years is really a blink of an eye in sort of geopolitical time frame, and that the US should basically concede Taiwan and cut them loose. Now, the optics of and the strategy, to be blunt, of deserting a democratic ally to an authoritarian one-party dictatorship of nature is not good, to say the very least. And then perhaps more beyond the sort of optics and the values question, wouldn't this embolden China? Doesn't this say, hey, you know, we're essentially rewarding bad behaviour in the same way that we deal with North Korea, because it encourages nuclear proliferation, not keeps it in check. So how do you respond to the notion that this will basically be kind of grist in the mill of an aggressive and assertive China?
Yes. Well, it's an argument that's often made. I'm a little bit sceptical as to whether the US abandoning Taiwan, at least in the phased way that I suggest, overall. I'm not suggesting in the book that the US abandoned Taiwan overnight. What I'm really arguing is that the US shouldn't be looking to kind of make Taiwan a central feature of its emerging strategic competition with China. I think if we are going to see strategic competition between the US and China, the US would be better to wage that competition in areas where it enjoys what the former US Secretary of State Dean Acheson talked about during the 1950s as situations of strength. And I don't think that Taiwan militarily or strategically is a situation of strength for the United States, in the same way that the East China Sea and arguably also the Korean Peninsula are. I think that if we look 3 decades, I can't envisage a scenario where the US, where China is able to challenge the US seriously in a military way in the East China Sea or on the Korean Peninsula. I think that's not going to be the case as far as the Taiwan Straits is concerned. So, I mean, the argument about abandoning a democratic ally, one could argue that that the US already did that in the 1970s as part of the normalisation of US-China relations.
It wasn't democratic then, though.
So. that's a very good point too. But it's also no longer a formal ally. So it's a de facto ally at best. So I mean, it may be a move that makes that makes other. What I suggest in the book is I try to suggest, rather than just an overnight abandonment in the same way that happened in the late 1970s, I try to suggest a phased approach where the US still continues to sell weaponry to Taiwan, but basically tries to encourage Taiwan to develop a much greater degree of self-reliance than it has at the moment. Because I think the reality is that over time, the ability of the US to intervene in this flashpoint is going to diminish over time. And I think that in terms of that argument about, well, what message does this send in terms of emboldening China, I think that's where the other argument about really holding down on these situations of strength in the East China Sea and the and on Korea is a way to avoid that, and to make clear that that's where the US defensive perimeter or defensive line is in Asia.
But the idea of a phased abandonment. It doesn't cross things too far. But surely the moment you kind of signal to some degree that this is not the priority once was, the door's basically open.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I'm a bit unsure how you practically manage phasing that. But let's turn to Korea, because you've sort of foreshadowed the sense there that where, you know, if you're imagining a kind of new American strategic region in which essentially a degree of concession has been given to Taiwan towards the PRC, the opposite is happening on the Korean Peninsula. And you, again, contrary to what a lot of people would argue at the moment, where you see, you hear a lot of voices saying, let's cut some kind of deal with North Korea, whether that's a deal that says, you know, the CVID mantra of complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization, or whether it's something, some threshold below that, there's a strong view that says we can parlay a deal and reduce the tensions in the Korean Peninsula and ultimately have a higher levels of strategic stability. You say double down on this one, and hold the line on the Korean Peninsula. Yeah. Surely this is increasing tensions, not decreasing them.
Yes, I mean I would think it was fantastic if we could reach some kind of deal, or if a diplomatic solution to the Korean flashpoint could be arrived at. I just don't see that happening. And I think if we look back over the past quarter century of this flashpoint, a lot of the things that are happening now are really a repeat of history of the same patterns that have occurred before. I think there have been some important gains made. The four-point agreement that was reached in Singapore between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, there's been some progress on those 4 points of agreement, particularly a couple of weeks ago, the North Koreans returned some of the remains of US personnel killed during the Korean War. And I think that for the families of those personnel, that's a great thing that happened. It's an important symbolic gesture, an important confidence-building measure. But I think when we really start to move up to the area of high politics and what I think the US is trying to get out of this, the denuclearization of North Korea, as you say, that I think now the term is a fully final, verifiable disarmament. I think the acronym changes every...
CVID is very 2004, yeah.
But essentially the same thing. I think that that's the US objective and the stated US objective. There's been some suggestions, including by a very eminent Stanford professor and nuclear scientist called Siegfried Hecker, that's suggested that process is likely to take 10 to 15 years to play out. On the other hand, if I was Kim Jong-un, I can't imagine a situation in which I would give up my nuclear weapons. And I mean, I'm quite moderate. I'm a big softie on some of these. For Kim Jong-un, I just can't see him giving up his last bargaining chip. I think we've already begun to see in the few months since the Singapore summit, there have been some sticking points. And this is going to be a very long, difficult and drawn-out, protracted diplomatic process. If we get to that end point 10 to 15 years from now and a diplomatic agreement is reached, I think over that time frame, the chances for things to go off the rails are pretty high. And so what I argue in the book is, rather than the US going back and looking at military options, which I don't think there is really a credible military option for the US on the Korean Peninsula, at least one with acceptable costs and risks, that's where the argument comes down, that I think the US and its allies should really look to adopt a very robust deterrence posture to leave the North Koreans in no doubt that if they use the nuclear weapons, that'll be the end of North Korea as a functioning society, with the hope of deterring North Koreans from ever using those terrible weapons. So that's really where the doubling down comes in. I hope that diplomacy continues to progress, and history doesn't always repeat, but I think based on history and based what we're seeing in the months since the Singapore summit, I'm not confident that we're going to see it continue to progress as we might hope.
So the sense of doubling down is essentially to say we've got to learn to live with a nuclear North Korea.
Yeah.
We have to hem it in behind a robust deterrence framework. Yeah. What happens if the Trump administration does strike a deal? So let's say, for whatever reason, whether it's the current crises, Trump feels he needs a foreign policy win. A lot of critics felt that the Singapore summit was more style than substance in terms of a lot of headlines and not a lot of progress, although I do think it played an important circuit breaker in terms of what was getting to be quite a tense period. But let's say they do strike a deal for whatever reason, in which you've got some kind of concession towards North Korea by the United States, in return for which North Korea gives up much but its nuclear weapons.
Yes, yeah.
Then what happens?
Well,
I know it's not your argument.
No, I think it's a very good question. And I think that certainly if anyone can strike a deal, I think the good news is that Donald Trump is probably the president out of anyone that we've had in recent times that has the ability to strike such a deal. But the big question I would have is that what kind of deal is this? If it's for instance, if it's a deal between the US and China, and one could envisage such a deal between the US and China, where say the United States agrees to rein in back from Taiwan in return for Xi Jinping really using the considerable economic leverage that he has against North Korea, that one could imagine that kind of deal. One could imagine a deal where the US and North Korea strike a deal, bilaterally, where Kim Jong-un agrees to give up some of his weapons, namely the ones that can hit the United States, in return for you know, diplomatic recognition or some form of energy support or a peace treaty. One could imagine that kind of deal as well. But I think whichever of those deals that you strike, one of the difficult things is that, as you know from your own work, Nick, it's a very diverse region, and there's a lot of influential players in this part of the world. And even the smaller and medium-sized countries have a degree of influence. So, for instance, you could imagine a US-China bargain or deal that was struck. Taiwan is probably not going to go down without a fight in that situation. You could imagine Taiwan then doing something that the United States and China would both be opposed to, and that's doing as it did during the 1960s and 1970s, and even as recently as the 1980s, looking to develop its own nuclear weapons as a means of defending itself. You could see it's certainly under significant pressure as a result of China cutting off its economic assistance, looking elsewhere, like looking to Russia for greater support, or looking to other transnational criminal groups and illicit elements, selling its nuclear know-how to other rogue regimes around the world. So that kind of grand bargain, say, between the US and China is going to be difficult to implement in a very diverse and complex region such as Asia. I think the same happens as a result of a US-North Korea deal over the intercontinental ballistic missiles. You could, for instance, envisage a situation there where the whole US network of alliances in Asia unwrapped. The South Koreans and particularly the Japanese become nervous that they can no longer trust in that nuclear umbrella that the US has provided to them, saying, "We'll you don't need to develop your own nuclear weapons because we'll protect you with ours." You go back to a situation similar to that during the Cold War where Japan starts to ask, would the United States really be willing to sacrifice San Francisco or Los Angeles in defense of Tokyo? You could potentially see a more hardline president in South Korea than the current president, Moon Jae-in, asking the same question. So you could begin to see an unraveling of that alliance network. And I mean, that might be something that Trump might not be all that concerned about, but I think that in the best interests of the United States, and I think there's a lot of, certainly people in the establishment in the United States would be opposed to that as well.
One last question, just sort of following up on that specific issue, is regardless of whether we see a deal or a kind of hardening up on the position on the Korean Peninsula, I think we're looking realistically at a world in which North Korea is a nuclear weapons state. And you mentioned that that old abandonment fear that client states have who are under the quote-unquote nuclear umbrella. Some people have made the argument that North Korea's nuclear weapons essentially make the nuclear umbrella unreliable. Now, I was wondering where you stand on this, because I actually tend to think that the circumstance is not that different from the Cold War. So the question mark, the same question mark you had in your mind if you're sitting in Tokyo about the promise the Americans give you to defend you from a Soviet attack is kind of the same as the attack from North Korea, where some scholars and others have argued that North Korea is different from the Soviet Union because the US is not involved in these big systemic conflicts, Cold War style ideological conflict that means that there's a lot more on the table in terms of a kind of credibility issue. That is, the US has to defend a Tokyo from attack, that it doesn't have to quite the same degree with North Korea. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I stand in a very similar position to you on that, Nick, and I think it's not all that dissimilar to the Cold War. And I mean, there's if you look at deterrence and having an effective deterrence strategy, the capability element is one part of it, and certainly the US has the capability to strike North Korea. We think that North Korea, if it can't already strike parts of the United States, it's certainly getting pretty close to developing that capability. So certainly there's the capability side of it. There's also the intentions. Having an effective deterrence strategy, you need to convince your opponent that you're willing to use those weapons. And I think certainly that's a challenge for the United States, I think. And during the Cold War, it was able to rise to that challenge. During the Eisenhower administration, it developed measures that it was able to assure its allies sufficiently that it would be willing to use nuclear weapons in in a more limited conflict in defence of allied capitals, even though that would put the United States at risk. I think there's some pretty hard thinking that needs to be done in the United States to what an Eisenhower strategy looks like today, but I think that it is possible. And I think certainly my own sense is I don't, unless it's on the verge of collapse, and even then it's probably an outlandish scenario where North Korea actually wants to use its nuclear weapons in an offensive way. I think it's got those weapons primarily for defensive reasons. So I think that the nuclear umbrella still has some utility. It may need some adjustment, particularly on that that intention side and the assurance or the reassurance of allies. But I think that some still pretty serious opposition domestically within Japan to Japan going nuclear. I think that we've still got, it's not inconceivable, but we've still got a ways to go in a situation where nuclear proliferation starts breaking out in Asia.
Okay, let's move away from the potential of nuclear proliferation and apocalypse on the Korean Peninsula to the far more relaxed environment of the South China Sea, where you can go scuba diving on a Malaysian atoll, which is also reclaimed land, but by all accounts, quite good scuba diving. You're actually pretty sanguine, as you said at the top, about the prospects of this flashpoint teeing off, and actually I tend to agree with that broader proposition. But you also then, I think, take a step that would leave many kind of little unsure as to whether they want to go with you, and that is essentially saying, this is the South China Sea is where we should give China some space, thinking about that, again, that new strategic dispensation in the region, the new balance. This involves essentially going back to the old historical norm where this is part of a Chinese sphere of influence or however you want to conceive it. Why do you think this is the case? And surely, you know, to ask the dubious provocative, the dubious historical analogy, but I'll do it because I can, doesn't this set the kind of Czechoslovakia analogy to an authoritarian China?
I guess a couple of points in response to the question, Nick. And the first is that, I mean, part of it is just the as the military balance of power shifts. The new US Indo-Pacific commander, Admiral Davison, during his testimony before he succeeded Harry Harris as the Indo-Pacific commander, basically said that short of conflict, short of armed conflict, the US no longer really has any strategic options in the South China Sea as far as China's artificial islands are concerned. And I think the strategic geography of that flashpoint just really favours the Chinese too strongly over time. I mean, certainly there are limits to their ability to project power over that entire body of water. I certainly don't suggest that the United States overnight should just stop sailing its ships through those waters. But I once again, it's a little bit like the Taiwan argument. I argue that for a de-emphasis of that particular area in its emerging strategic competition with China. I argue for an ending to the freedom of navigation operations, and, you know, sailing ships and aircraft inside the 12 nautical mile zones around those disputed features, partly because I think that they're ineffectual. And I think over time, I think we're going to see a situation where the ability of the United States to continue to control in that particular area is going to diminish. But then it gets to the second point you made about the appeasement argument, or is this kind of like Neville Chamberlain revisited? And certainly there are some interesting parallels between Nazi Germany and China today. I mean, there's a lot of parallels between most great powers, not all great powers, but most great powers as they rise behave in a very similar way to how China is behaving today, or to how Nazi Germany behaved in the lead up to the Second World War. But I think that there are also some very important differences. And one of the key differences is, I think, if you look back to the history of that Second World War, Hitler was basically hell-bent on achieving hegemony no matter what the cost, and he was hell-bent on using military means to do that. I think one of the differences is, I think Xi Jinping is intent on achieving hegemony as well. But I think he's trying to do that using all measures short of war. He doesn't really want to get there by using military measures, at least not at this point in time. So I think that, you know, one of the questions to ask is what's the US strategic objective in this situation? Is it to remain the dominant power, to remain the benign hegemon of Asia and to continue to exert control over this whole region? Or is it to China from becoming the hegemon in Asia? And I think if you look back historically over the history of US grand strategy, I think that latter objective has actually been the paramount objective, that the US wants to prevent a potentially hostile power gaining control of that of the Asian region, and particularly that Eurasian landmass. And I think what I try and suggest in the book is a way that the US can do that. And that's where I think it's different than the kind of the Neville Chamberlain analogy, because I think if the US establishes where these situations of strength exist and makes clear that it's going to defend those situations of strength, potentially even through the use of military force if need be, I think that's the most critical for having a stable balance of power going forward into the future. So I think if I was to look at a historical analogy, it would probably be more the analogy of the Korean War a few years after the Second World War, where Dean Acheson, the person who I kind of borrow his ideas of situations of strength, made a very famous speech just leading up to the Korean War, where he talked in a very similar way. He talked about a US defense perimeter in Asia and talked about the areas of Asia that the US would defend and the areas that it wouldn't defend. And Acheson, in that speech, left out Korea, and Joseph Stalin saw that as a green light to say to Kim Il-sung, the grandfather of North Korea's current, can go ahead now and attack the South. And I think the mistake the US made at that point in time was they didn't get the defensive line right. They subsequently changed their mind and under a UN banner went in and supported the South Koreans. So I think that for me that's a real historical analogy we should be looking at it. And I think at the moment, and it's not just under the Trump administration, I think it was also the same thing, similar thing was going on under the Obama administration. The US is at the moment trying to work out where its defensive perimeter in Asia, exactly where that line is, where it would be willing to use military force if push came to shove, and where it we've seen it kind of leaning in and then leaking on the South China Sea, is that it hasn't really worked out where that line is. And I think the key to avoiding a Chamberlain type scenario is getting a much clearer sense of where that defensive perimeter or where that defensive line exists, and then being credible in the defence of that.
Because one of the things I really admire about that book is the sense that, you know, we know that it's frankly impossible to imagine that the US and its allies can sustain a strategic balance in Asia as if it was always going to be 1998. Mm-hmm. And yet that's kind of sort of where we still are. And I think what you do is think through carefully how adjustments need to be made, where we don't have to give up themes of a significant American presence in the region, but recognise that there is a shifting balance of power. But what do you think are the consequences, though, of basically saying South China Sea is a Chinese lake once again? What are the implications of that?
I actually don't think there is the consequences are as severe as a lot of alarmist commentators suggest. If we can take the Australian case for example, a lot of commentators have said that this waterway, this body of water, is immensely significant to Australia because it's very hard to estimate exactly
lots of shipping.
But somewhere around the 60% of our exports go through. And a lot of energy exports go through these waters, but if you actually look at where those exports are going to, the vast majority of them go to China. So I think that, I mean, China itself, it doesn't use the terms, you know, free and open Indo-Pacific, but I think China is just as interested in having a free and open waters as any other country in the region. And I think one of the reasons why we're seeing it start to think about where its own perimeter, its own kind of defensive line or its own strategic perimeter is precisely for that reason. It's kind of the constant denials on the part of the US and us and other allies that you know, we're not trying to contain China. There's still a very strong perception in Beijing that that's exactly what we're trying to do. And so I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons why the Chinese themselves are starting to push out and try and gain a greater sense of strategic space, because they're worried about being hemmed in. So I'm actually less worried about the Chinese dominance in the South China Sea, or control of that body of water. I think in a conflict scenario, yes, those straits that kind of connect the Indian Ocean to the Pacific are strategically important. But hopefully we can avoid that scenario eventuating.
Well, let's turn to the last of the flashpoints in the East China Sea. So this is the dispute center. The centers around the rocky islands that the Japanese call the Senkaku and the Chinese call the Diaoyu. It's a surprisingly low profile dispute within the Australian context, at any rate, and yet it's, in your estimation, one of the, you know, one of the more explosive, and certainly one of the more and it's a place where the US, China, and Japan all have vital interests at stake. You've got it on the ledger of the US should draw its line. Why? I mean, if you just approach the region blankly and look at it and you say the US is going to cut Taiwan loose, but it's going to draw a line on the sand, so to speak, on these rocky islands, 100 nautical miles to the northeast of Taiwan.
Yes.
Why defend here and not the 23 million Democrats in... small D Democrats, I should say, in Taiwan.
Yes. I think partly because it can. I think if you look at, once again, the military balance of power, the US and the Japanese militaries, particularly the way in which they're operating around the East China Sea, they're more and more interdependent. They're being very, very closely. The systems they operate are very interlinked. So I think that certainly the Japanese military itself, it's a reasonably small military, but it's a very potent, very powerful air force, very potent navy as well. So I think that combined with the United States, at least into the foreseeable future, if you look at the balance of power between the US and Japan on the one side and China on the other, it favours the US and Japan very, very strongly. In fact, the case can even be made that over the next 10 to 20 years, Japan is one of the few militaries that could potentially hold its own against China, because, you know, it's very modern and sophisticated air and naval forces. So I think one of the reasons why I suggest that the US should double down and try and maintain that situation of strength, and it might actually mean shifting even more assets, military assets, into that theatre, is to try and preserve that favourable balance of power, which I don't think it will be able to do in Taiwan or the South China Sea. And the other reason is just because of the importance of that US-Japan alliance. You'll often hear US policymakers talk about that alliance as being the cornerstone of the American presence in this part of the world. And I think it's certainly possible to think about the military presence in Asia without an alliance with Taiwan, because it's done that since the late 1970s. It's even possible to imagine the US maintaining a presence in Asia without the US-Korea alliance. In fact, George Kennan, one of the great American strategists, the architect of the containment strategy, actually proposed something even more radical than I'm proposing. He proposed a much greater pulling back from Asia. But I think, I think pulling back from Korea would be the wrong thing to do. And I think that the US, for a number of decades now, has it's not just a feature of Trump. I think that the strategic importance of that alliance with South Korea for some decades now. But it is possible to envisage the US maintaining a presence in Asia without the alliance with South Korea. It's very difficult, though, to imagine the US continuing to maintain a presence in Asia without that alliance with Japan. I think if you take that alliance away, I think I think it's unlikely the US will retreat from Asia, but that would be, I think, the step that would really signal a US retreat from Asia. And I think it's one of the reasons why we've seen US Defense Secretary James Mattis come out and say that in the case of a conflict in the the East China Sea Japan Mutual Security Treaty continues to apply. The same thing that it extends to such a contingency in the same way that President Obama twice when he was president became the first president to publicly state that that treaty applied to a contingency in the East China Sea. So that's why I differentiate the East China Sea from the Taiwan flashpoint.
But do you think, I remember that very clearly, that 2013, I think it was 2013, when Abe was back and he went to the US in December and was like, please say Senkakus, please say Senkakus, please say, and he didn't. And then he went in April and he did. And I remember thinking, something's shifted here where for decades, certainly conservative Japanese probably wanted that public explicit commitment that says, these islands are covered. This is as if it were, you know, Tokyo Bay.
Yes.
And Obama gave in. I think he gave in. I don't think it was a considered strategic choice. Why do you think that was the case? I mean, do you think it was a recognition of weakness, or do you think it was getting ahead of a kind of dynamic that you're describing?
Yes. I mean, I think it was, in part, it was to try and reassure the Japanese. This came at a time, you know, you'll remember back to 2013, 2014, that tensions were really heating up around the East China Sea following Japan's nationalisation of the Kaku Islands back in September of 2012. It's hello. But I think partly it was also a reflection of the fact that strategic competition by this stage was really, you know, starting to really heat up in Asia. You know, that the crisis slide that I talk about was really beginning to gain momentum, and I think we saw a return of we've been seeing a return of what might be termed power politics to Asia, where a lot of these things like alliance commitments and start to become more important, and countries become more insistent on them, and allies want to reassure one another. I mean, we saw a similar phenomenon in the period. You know, before the as well, that kind of tightening of alliances that occurred during that time. So that's you know, one of the features of the crisis slide that I think was occurring, and which explains that shift in at least publicly that shift in the US commitment to Japan during that period.
Before I throw to the floor for some questions, I want to just try to draw out a couple of themes in the book, and then ask you to look in your crystal ball. But one of the things that really struck me about the kind of new balance that you describe, and it relates to your earlier remarks about the South Asian disputes being kind of separate, is you describe a region which, from a geopolitical kind of big conflict point of view, in which the Indian Ocean region remains pretty distinct and separate from the Western Pacific or the East Asian theatre, and describes a region where the big strategic dynamics are not Indo-Pacific but are in fact East Asian and Asia-Pacific. And in particular, you're essentially recommending the United States that focus its efforts on Northeast Asia. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair reading? Or like, and from that, it seems to be, why on earth would the Americans go to the trouble of describing an Indo-Pacific strategy with an Indo-Pacific command stuff when the strategic dynamic, as you discern it, is not Indo-Pacific at all?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think the Indo-Pacific concept, I mean, it's a very nice kind of neat concept. It's one that Australia is quite proud of, the fact that it's been a champion, a bit of a cheerleader for this particular concept. I think it's a very nice concept in theory. I think it's one that makes a lot of sense for Australia because it's kind of big and expansive and inclusive, and it means that those questions about whether we're part of this region or not kind of are laid to rest if this concept catches on. But I think it's also a concept that in practice is going to be much more difficult to implement, particularly if we see, as I predict, I would argue we're already seeing an intensification of strategic competition. I think certainly in peacetime, you can call the region anything you want, and it doesn't really matter all that much. I mean, regions are kind of imagined; they're very subjective anyway. They don't exist in reality. But I think once you get into a period of strategic competition, and I think, you know, the tensions over the Doklam Plateau, for instance, are a good example of that. Japan sent an expression of support to India during that that particular standoff, but you didn't see the US or Japan sending troops to that. And I don't think if tensions really flared up into a major conflict, I don't think we'd see that sort of mission emerging across the Doklam Plateau. Similarly, if we saw tensions flaring up over the Taiwan Strait or in the East China Sea, I don't think we'd see a situation where India was sending forces to support the US and Japan and that particular a conflict over the East China Sea. So I think that the idea kind of breaks down. It kind of, I suppose I would argue that flies in the face of the argument that the Indo-Pacific isn't emerging as a strategic system, because for me the definition of a strategic system is a system where developments in one part of that system kind of resonate or affect other parts. And I think that if you have something major like a conflict breaking out in one part of the countries in another part of that system aren't becoming involved, they're just staying completely out of it, then that to me suggests that it's not a strategic system. So you're absolutely right. I see a situation where we're likely to see two separate, largely separate strategic systems. There may at times be a degree of interaction between them, but I think largely the South Asian and the East Asian strategic systems will continue to remain relatively separate.
The second thing that really strikes me about the book is the role of nationalism. And this is the thing, I think, you know, if you're kind of sitting there going, what's the joker in the pack in all of this, which not just nationalism seems to be back with a bit of a vengeance, but it's a pretty angry, chauvinistic, puritanical kind of nationalism in lots of parts of the region, whether you know, India, Japan, certainly Xi Jinping, but you know, arguably a kind of, that's a kind of nationalism that's behind, that's the wind in the sails of Trump's election. Why is it back? And from a, you know, strategic thinkers often don't talk about nationalism. It's about, you know, poise and equipoise and balances of power and throw weights, and it's all fairly dispassionate. How do you sort of try to factor that into the analysis, and what can we do about it?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think that, as you know, is a very complex phenomenon, and it has comes from a number of different sources. But I think its prevalence in Asia today can be attributed to a number of factors. One is the fact that a number of these countries that have had very, very difficult pasts. You think about a country like China, for instance, and the travails that it's been through. You know, the tens of millions that died, for instance, during the Cultural Revolution, the so-called century of humiliation that where China was essentially, as once great civilization, was carved up at the hands of colonial powers. And I think that there's, you know, a large proportion of the Chinese population are really proud now about what their country has achieved, what their nation has achieved. I think the same is true for others like the Japanese, even the Koreans as well. So I think that's one of the fact. A number of these countries have you know, school book curriculums that also where a lot of this, you know, very strong nationalistic sentiment has been imbued with these with the citizens of these countries since kindergarten age, partly as a way of holding these you know, often fractious nations together and kind of building a sense of resilience amongst the country. So I think that the roots of it are very deep seated, and its prevalence is you know, it is very worrying. Be familiar with the old saying that history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme, and I think we're seeing, it's one of the reasons why I'm attracted to the idea of the crisis slide, because if we look at the period in Europe prior to the First World War, there are a number of similarities between, I mean, there are a lot of differences, but there are also some very strong similarities between that region on the eve of the First World War in Asia today. And we've talked about the tightening of alliances. I think the kind of the rise of nationalism is another commonality between the two theatres. But where I think that nationalism is most dangerous is in the case of the East China Sea flashpoint. I think that if you look at it at a purely collective level, it doesn't make any sense at all for two of the world's leading economies to end up fighting a war with each other. You know, the idea is that China and Japan would go to war over a set of rocks in the East China Sea just seems ludicrous to us sitting here in Melbourne here this evening. But I think that's where the nationalism comes into play and potentially becomes... could potentially become very flammable if you have a You know, you look at the levels of anti-Japanese sentiment in China, and some of the polling that's done on this suggests it's, you know, somewhere up in the 90% bracket of Japanese have a very strong anti-Chinese sentiment, and the same proportion of very strong anti-Japanese sentiment. And all you need is you know, something like what happened back in April of 2001, when a US surveillance aircraft and a Chinese jet fighter collided over the waters of the South China Sea. You get that happening over the East China Sea between a Chinese and a Japanese aircraft, and you start to see that nationalism start to ignite, and massive anti-Japanese demonstrations taking place over hundreds of Chinese cities. As we've seen before, you have the makings there for a situation that could very easily spiral out of control. So that's where I see the nationalism kind of playing into this. You're right that often strategists don't pay enough attention to this. Given the nature of the theatre we're looking at and the very strong, pervasive sense of nationalism in this theatre, I think it's something we need to pay more attention to.
All right, I'm going to come to the crystal ball at the end, but I know people will be desperate to pitch their own questions at you. Is it possible to get the house lights lit up a bit just so I can see a little bit? But let's go over here. So, Matt, if you could just hand the microphone.
Yeah, Brendan, I have a double-pronged question. Climate scientists are saying that if we don't drastically start cutting down on greenhouse gas emissions, which we're not doing despite the Paris Agreement and so forth, that we're going to move into 4D 2100, and a lot of people are talking about climate wars. There's been a number of books. And what happens when the glaciers in the Himalayas have melted? And then the other part of my question is, well, I certainly favor denuclearization in North Korea. Isn't there a bit of a double standard here? Why not get the United States and India and China and Pakistan to also denuclearize?
I mean, two small questions.
Yes, both really, really straightforward questions. Really, really good questions. I think I might take the second one, the second question first. I think that's certainly the argument that the North Koreans have put forward. The argument about, and I think that's one of the reasons why I see there being a real sticking point, and why, I mean, I don't like to be pessimistic, but I think I am pretty pessimistic on this particular flashpoint, because I think it's one of the real sticking points on the diplomacy around this flashpoint. That when, if you look back over the last 25 years, whenever the North Koreans have talked about denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they mean something very different than when the Americans talk about denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. And I think when the Koreans talk about this, the North Koreans talk about denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they have in mind what you're talking about. They argue that all countries should be, that are involved in this flashpoint, should be getting rid of their nuclear weapons. Whereas when the United States talks about denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, it's talking purely about North Korean denuclearization and before any kind of other benefits will be provided, that needs to be kind of the first step along the way. So I think that's that issue of denuclearization. I think the point you make is a fair one. It's one of the reasons why I think there's going to be a sticking point, because there's different interpretations of that. On the climate wars, I mean, I'm not an expert on climate. That I mean, certainly that's something that I worry about in terms of you know, even my own children's lifetime. But it's something which at least in terms of the scope of this book, I'm kind of really only looking at over the next kind of 20 to 30 years. So I'd I mean, I could hazard an answer at it, but it's not really my area of expertise. So I'd I think I'd probably best not. But it's an important area.
Go on. All right, got Ben Habib here, and then at the back there, so in the middle here. If you pass the microphone. There was a second mic, but it seems to have run away. Maybe it took fright at the thought of thermonuclear Armageddon. So. And then at the back there.
Thanks, Brendan.
It seems to me that hegemonic transition is this variable that's underpinning all of the flashpoints that you're talking about. And this is really a dynamic process that has a ticking clock on American primacy. So is this ticking clock on American power something that you think might make these flashpoints more volatile? Is there a line in the sand where the Americans might be forced to fight to maintain their position?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Ben, and I think the I think where that dynamic worries me most is in relation to the Taiwan flashpoint. That's the one where I think there is really a error in terms of unless we see something radical in terms of some, you know, dramatic kind of technological change in terms of the weaponry that different countries are able to use. I think based on the available information that we have, the ability of the US to come to Taiwan's defence is gradually diminishing and will be gone within that decade. So the question then is what does the US do with the time it's got in that decade? And you know, some have argued that the US needs to now really bolster its position and really, while it's still got that advantage, to be really using that advantage. I think changes in that approach, because I think out of all of the flashpoints, and they're all different, even though they're interconnected, Taiwan is the one that I think is the one that's the rawest for Beijing, the one where it's come out consistently over decades and said that this is a core interest. And when, as you would know, when the Chinese use the term core interest, they're using that to refer to issues over which they would use military force in the defence of those, in the defence of that particular issue. So I worry that the US potentially leaning in and taking a more robust approach during this kind of closing window could actually end up provoking the Chinese. I think if the US moved, I think Xi still believes that there are other measures short of war that he can use to try and reclaim Taiwan. And I think as long as he believes that the chance of war across the Taiwan Strait are fairly remote, because I think Xi doesn't want a military operation. It would still entail costs and risks for the Chinese. But I think my worry is through either a Taiwanese declaration of independence or by America leaning too far forward on this particular flashpoint that it ends up provoking Xi into doing something that he otherwise wouldn't do.
And there is that sense, I think, also that if you've got a logic as to for, that's to say, then that will help you have a clearer sense as to whether you need to see off a threat within a fixed time frame. When primacy is an end unto itself, or questions of honour and prestige and that sort of thing factor in, then that time, I think that time pressure becomes much more acute and leads to potentially curious outcomes. Now, the next one was at the back there, and then here, and then here.
Aaron Soans, the APEC Study Centre. I was wondering to what extent a trade war could spill over into an actual war. Many people argue that trade prevents war, but if those trade flows are disrupted, do you think that could quicken the flashpoints?
Yeah, another really good and I think certainly on that last point that you raise about, you know, a lot of people do say trade prevents war. I mean, it's a very long, enduring argument with a, you know, as you would know, you know, a very distinguished lineage. But I think it's one of the arguments that I really worry about in Asia at the moment today, that argument, along with the argument that the preservation of, that the presence of nuclear weapons means that war is unthinkable, has really generated a sense of complacency in Asia at the moment. And this, you know, this complacency is another one of the features of a crisis slide, that you kind of go of crises and leaders think, oh well, we managed to work our way through those crises that crisis, and then another one happens and we manage to work our way through that. And the kind of the idea that war could actually result from one of these crises kind of becomes almost unthinkable, or states, people start to become very relaxed about the prospect that war could emerge. So I think that you know, just to pick up on that last part of your question, I think that's one of the assumptions that we need to question a lot more carefully. And I know today that the nature of economic interdependence in Asia is very, very different to the type of economic interdependence that we saw in Europe on the eve of the First World War. But, I mean, people making very similar arguments, including a very famous book by Norman Angell that was published in 1910, where he talked about the idea of Europe going to war back in at that particular point, it just wouldn't make any sense. And 4 years later, war broke out. But I think the other part of your question, could a trade war spill over into conflict? I think that's certainly a possibility, depending upon what economic impacts the trade war has. If we see the trade war, and we don't really know at this stage exactly how it's going to play out between the US and China, but if we see that trade war start to have really damaging impacts upon the Chinese economy, and there's already speculation that it's starting to have some impacts, and that China's kind of publicly stated growth figures of around about the 6.5% per annum mark are actually closer to kind of the around the one, just above 1% growth per annum at the moment. If we started to see an economic downturn in China as a result of that that particular trade war, we could potentially see a situation where Xi's position domestically, which only a few months ago looked very strong because of the party basically got rid of presidential term limits, meaning that he could potentially be China's leader for his whole life. That situation could potentially become much weaker very quickly, and he could potentially face pressure from within his own party and within the country more generally to take a strong stance. And then so you could, I mean, some of you will remember there was a very, very famous movie that came out, 20 or so years ago called Wag the Dog, where a president in the US started a conflict to kind of distract from domestic troubles. You could imagine that a wag the dog phenomenon happening within China, where a Xi who was feeling insecure, where his leadership was feeling insecure, decides to behave more assertively or aggressively, potentially by using force, say in relation to the Taiwan issue or on one of the other flashpoints. So I think there's certainly, I know I came about answering your question kind of from back the front, but I also wanted to pick up on that last point. But I think the point you raise is a good one as well. We could potentially, as we've seen throughout history, and in fact as we saw in the period prior to the Second World War, we could see economic downturn contribute to major power conflict.
All right, Melissa, just here.
Melissa Conley Tyler from the Australian Institute of International Affairs, and thank you, Brendan, for speaking to me on our Australian Outlook blog about the book.
Product placement.
Help, I think you put your arguments very cogently and gave very clear policy prescriptions. My question is, how are they being received? So do you think there's any prospect that either Australian policymakers or, God forbid, US policymakers might listen to some of these views?
Yeah. It's a great question, and the honest answer, and thanks for coming along as well, Melissa, it's always great to see you. It's still very early days. The book's only been out for just over a week. In fact, the interview I did on Australian Outlook was the very, very first interview I did on the book. So thank you for that. But my sense is that certainly in Australia at the moment, I think this argument being kind of adopted or implemented at the governmental level are probably fairly remote at the moment, partly because there's just such an emphasis on the Indo-Pacific, and it kind of comes back to some of the points that Nick was making. And I think, for Australia, for reasons I stated, I think that makes up with a region that includes Australia is important. And I think that there is a genuine attempt on the part of the government, to assuming we still have the same government as we had at the start of this session, to try and shape it a balance of power. That worries me is that the type of balance of power that they're trying to shape, I'm not sure in the end how credible that's going to be. And I think that we need to also be thinking about other, and as I said about the Indo-Pacific, it's a great concept in theory, but I think we also need to think about, there's always more than there's different variants of stable power balances as you would know, and I think thinking about what are going to be other potentially stable power balances in our region, because I think in the end, Australia has a number of strategic objectives, but I think one of those obviously the defence of the Australian continent, but I think the other, if you look back through our history, one of our overriding strategic objectives has been to maintain a stable balance of power in this part of the world, and to live in a stable region. And so the honest answer is I don't think this argument will be picked up yet, but perhaps when things start to deteriorate further, it might gain some. I hope it'll gain some serious consideration.
I think one of the challenges for this sort of thinking that's in the book resonating in Washington is, as yet, there's not a consensus view about the scale of the kind of challenge that China presents. And particularly, I think there's still, I think it's wrong, but I think, which is my view, that China presents the kind of significant challenge to American primacy in the region, that China is still a second-tier power. I think until that view shifts, I think this will be seen as, yeah, a bit too ahead. Yeah, not yet. Now, person in the middle there. Yep.
Thank you. Nicholas Phibbs. Brendan, I know this may not be your area of expertise. Do you believe the flashpoints you've spoken about tonight are more likely to lead to a global conflict than, say, Putin's push for Russia to exert more influence in Europe through Crimea and the Ukraine, or Matt's ambitious nuclear plans?
I mean, I'm a little bit biased because I work on Asia, but I think that... I mean, certainly, I'd come back again to that, potential for wide war. I think once again, I think there is potential for. I mean, there is potential for conflict between the US and Russia. I think there is potential for a conflict in Iran to bring in the great powers as well. But I think out of the three, if I was to compare between the three, I think, you know, still going back to that kind of the blamey. Idea of wide war. I think that these funds to have the potential to bring the major powers into war. But I don't know. Perhaps we can talk to Chris afterwards about the nine flashpoints.
Flashpoints volume three. So just here, yeah.
Hi, Emma from La Trobe University. My question is fairly straightforward. You mentioned at one point that you feel that President Trump is likely to make a deal with North Korea than his predecessors. Could you explain that?
Mm. I always get nervous when someone says they're going to ask me a straightforward question. That's a good question. I think probably what I meant by that was it comes from the fact that Trump it kind of comes from a business background, so he kind of, you know, he's written this famous book called The Art of the Deal. He's kind of has a reputation for being able to strike deals. I think that reputation, that experience is probably one of the reasons why I think, but also just because he's I think he's just a very very different kind of unconventional figure compared to his. Compared to his predecessors. I think that was kind of the other kind of idea that I had in mind there, that he's shown his willingness, sometimes I think in a negative way or in a detrimental way, to kind of throw out the traditional diplomat. But I think on an issue like North Korea that's been so long and difficult and protracted, the traditional diplomatic playbook hasn't worked. So I think that those were kind of the two things I had in mind. One was his kind of business experience of kind of wheeling and dealing and deal making, but the other was his kind of unconventional approach, his willingness to try things that kind of move away from or move outside those kind of traditional diplomatic approaches.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that sense of being rationally thinking through the kind of cost benefits of a particular policy, North Korea, you know, there's so many downsides to it that it really hems in your options. But if you're a guy like Trump, it's like, don't worry about that, then you do hit different kind of calculus around how you think of these things. I mean, yeah, I think from a purely, like, is he likely to cut some kind of deal? He's got a lot more freedom of maneuver just because of the way he thinks. Now, whether that produces good outcomes, separate question. Fran, we've got one right at the back, one here and one here. So if everyone's quick, we can get through these three, and that's probably, I'm afraid we probably won't get to you, but we'll see. If we can keep them quick.
Hey, good evening. So my question was around energy security and its role in potential conflicts. Basically due to the amount of countries in Asia that need imports for the energy supplies and the current changes going on in the global energy.
Yeah, well, I think energy security certainly, feeds into a number of these flashpoints. On the South China Sea and the East China Sea, arguably the resources lying underneath those waters are a big factor that are driving those conflicts. I think on the Korean Peninsula, energy is very important as well, particularly that the link between Russia and North Korea. I think it's a relationship that, we looked a lot at during the Cold War, the relationship between the Soviet Union and North Korea. The Soviet Union was kind of North Korea's major kind of patron along with China during the Cold War, but it's a relationship we don't tend to look as much about in the book. But those kind of energy relationships, Russia has many, many weaknesses, but, it's still got a formidable nuclear arsenal. It's also, in many respects, an energy superpower with the oil and particularly the gas reserves that it has. So that's an important energy security dimension. I think for Australia also, the South China Sea energy dimension is important as well, in that it's unlikely that, in my view, that we'll see a major conflict in the South China Sea. But if we did, that could have, very severe ramifications for Australia. I think the level of fuel supplies that we keep in the country is something in the vicinity of about 28% of fuel. We would still potentially be able to get fuel through those. I mean, it's a vast body of water, even in a conflict situation, but it would become more difficult. And I think we'd begin to see pretty severe rationing and potentially an economic recession in Australia as well as a result of conflict breaking out in any of these theatres. So those are kind of the three kind of main energy dimension angles that I see to these four flashpoints.
Okay, down here.
Hi. In the previous conversation, you kind of mentioned about the Hitler and the current leader, how they paralleled. Can you elaborate about that point? About to what extent do they behave the same? And the second question is, do you think that North Korea kind of used their nuclearization as a leverage advantage other than negotiating but to postpone the economic sanction?
Both good questions. And I think my point about Germany and China was probably less about the leaders themselves than about I think all major powers when they rise they want to have a greater say in shaping the international system as their power rises. And I think that was the case with Germany. Back in the period before the two world wars, I think it was the case with the United States. It emerged slowly, but as it did begin to emerge, it wanted to have a greater say in shaping the international system. I think it's the case with China today. I think it's just the way that great powers behave. Nick Bisley's actually written a really good book on great power behaviour that if you want to read more about how great powers behave. But, certainly my point wasn't really to compare Xi with Hitler. In fact, I think I see very between Xi's approach and Hitler's approach. I think Hitler placed a much greater emphasis on actually using military power, and he didn't really seem to consider the costs of using military power. I think if Xi can avoid using military power, I think he will do all that he can to try and increase China's influence in Asia and essentially for China to become even the dominant power in Asia without using military power. So I think that the two personalities, I think I see them as being quite different. I suppose my point was just the similarities between most great powers when they're rising kind of will have some similarities in their behaviour, but I think the differences between China and Germany are greater than the similarities. But I hope that helps to clarify that point. On the nuclear weapons and as leverage for lifting of sanctions, I think that there's really going to be a sequencing problem there, because I think on the one hand, the Trump administration and the Australian government has supported it very strongly, and in fact Julie Bishop, our foreign minister, has come out perhaps even more strongly than President Trump himself on this point, and has suggested that the sanctions need to remain in place, that the maximum, what Trump calls the maximum pressure campaign against North Korea needs to continue until the North Koreans will get rid of their nuclear weapons. The North Koreans, on the other hand, are basically not willing to get rid of their nuclear weapons until they see some concessions on the part of their. So I think how that works out, I think that'll be one of the things that's happening at the moment, is that how is this sequence? Back in the early 1990s and 1994, when the US and North Korea made a similar agreement, they actually came up with a sequence where a kind of an action for action, where one side would take some step and the other side would reciprocate, and there was a pattern that was supposed to kind of be followed through to the conclusion of that agreement. And the agreement eventually, after about 8 months, and fell apart. So I think that certainly North Korea would like to do that, but whether the United States is going to trust it sufficiently, and I think the answer is probably no, that it probably won't. And I think there's good reasons why the United States shouldn't trust the North Koreans on this point, because we've seen it. We've seen this with the North Koreans before. I think that's going to be the real sticking point, is that how does that sequencing occur? So North Koreans would like to do what you're suggesting. Whether they will be able to do it or they'll be allowed to do it, I think is much less likely.
Okay, one very quick one here at the front. I'm afraid the rest will have to join the queue to buy one of Brendan's books, and then you can ask him a question.
Thank you. In Linosis, would you favour an increase in Australian defence expenditure?
Mm.
Cut to the chase.
Yes, yes.
Certainly an increase in the investment in defence and strategic studies.
Well, I think it's one of the things that, you know, Trump has received a lot of criticism from many quarters. I think one of the things that he's done more effectively than any of his predecessors is he's been able to get US allies to start to take seriously the fact that the possibility of spending more on their defence. You know, Obama tried to do this as well, but wasn't particularly successful. I think the reality is that we probably are going to see increased defence expenditure in Australia. But I think one of the things in our debate that we haven't really thought through sufficiently is the extent or how great those those increases in defence expenditure will need to be, depending. I mean, that in the end should really be determined by the nature of our strategic environment. You often hear, an analyst talk about, oh, it should be 2% or 3% or 5%. I think in the end you've got to look at the nature of your strategic environment. One of the things I think that we underestimate in our debate, particularly about having a greater degree of independence from the United States, of that would be for Australia, and how much our defence expenditure would need to increase to compensate for that. And my own personal view, and this is my kind of intervention into the plan B debate about whether Australia should be looking for a plan B for defending itself, is I think that figure is much higher than many have contemplated at the moment. So, which is one of the reasons why I, although I'm suggesting in the book that the US should be looking to pull back from some parts of the region, ultimately I very much would like to see the US remain a presence in this part of the world, because I think that's something that's very critical to Australia's interests, and spend a little more on defence to keep the US in this part of the world. I think we'd have to spend significantly more on our defence if the US, in the unlikely event that the US vacated this part of the world. So, I mean, in answer to your question, a lot depends on the extent to which the strategic environment deteriorates, but I think almost certainly we are going to have to see some increases in defence expenditure in the period ahead.
All right. I will call Kelly back to the lectern to formally close this evening's proceedings.
Thanks very much, Nick. Please join me in thanking. That was fascinating. And I'd like to again thank Brendan and Nick for the discussion here on stage, and also like to thank you all for coming and engaging with them with such interesting and thought-provoking questions. The discussion tonight, I think you'll agree, has been especially relevant to us here in Australia, where key players and partners in the Indo-Pacific or Asia-Pacific. As the host this evening, I might remain neutral in that discussion. But keeping in mind how fascinating tonight's discussion has been, I'd like to remind all here that tickets are available for the next La Trobe Asia event, which is a launch of Marie's new book, Figuring Victims in International Criminal Justice, The Case of the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. It's on the 29th of August at our city campus in Collins Street, and I'm sure will be just as fascinating as this evening's discussion has been. And of course, I'd like to remind you of the launch of our very first issue of the La Trobe Asia Brief. This is a policy brief titled Cooperation in Contested Asia. This is on the afternoon of the 7th of September, also at our city campus in Collins Street. More information about these events can be found on the La Trobe Asia website. Thank you again for coming this evening. As Nick has mentioned, copies of the book are for the foyer, and Brendan will remain for a short time to sign copies if you would like him to do that. Again, please join me in thanking our speakers for this evening. Thank you.
You know, I've got a sign. Have you brought a pen?
Yes, the...